Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Thursday 28th of March with me, Ian Welsh. Regular listeners will know that the European Union's deforestation regulation, which comes fully into force at the end of 2024, and its implications on commodity supply chains has been a very hot topic over the past few months. To continue the conversation, I recently caught up with Joseph De Cruz, CEO of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, and Olivier Tichet, Chief Sustainability Officer at Muslim Mass. They gave some great insider insights, and the interview is very much worth a listen. That's coming up. First, though, is some sustainable business news. Drinks giant PepsiCo achieved its 2025 water efficiency target 2 years early in 2023, the company has announced. PepsiCo had committed to water use efficiencies of a 25% improvement in areas of high water risk by 2025 from a 2015 starting point. The company says that use of innovative technologies and a process of sharing and scaling best practices across the business have contributed to the achievements. For example, scaling a new approach to how the company washes maize when making branded products such as Tostitos, Fritos and Doritos to 100 global manufacturing lines over a 12-month period has potential to save more than 640 million litres of water every year. Another example the company gives is implementing membrane bioreactor technology at 21 manufacturing sites globally, including 14 in high water risk areas, to purify water used in manufacturing processes so that it can be reused in operations. This can reduce a site's freshwater demand by an average of 70%. Final example of innovation is PepsiCo taking the water that's naturally found in potatoes and using it to help run food manufacturing facilities. Implemented at sites in India, Mexico, Poland and Thailand, this technology captures and treats vapour that is released by potatoes when they are cooked to make snacks and converts it into drinkable water that is used to run manufacturing facilities. The process can save a single site up to 60 million litres of water per year. The UK government has announced that it does not intend to extend an incoming ban on the sale of imported products linked to illegal deforestation in the country of origin to products linked to deforestation that is technically legal. The House of Commons Environmental Audit Committee had been pushing the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs to extend the ban to cover products linked to all deforestation. Palm oil, cocoa, soy and cattle products are within the scope of the rules. Concerns about the non-extension have been raised by stakeholders including business and environmental NGOs. The chair of the Environmental Audit Committee, Philip Dunn MP, commented that UK business should not be trading in products linked to deforestation, as defined by the UN, if the UK is going to be in a position to provide leadership, with failing to prohibit such trade giving what he described as mixed signals. The Senate in the US state of Florida has passed a bill that bans local legislatures from being able to pass laws requiring companies to provide water, shade and regular breaks to protect outdoor workers from heat exposure. These measures can mean the difference between workers being subject or not to significant health problems, including kidney failure and even death. Anyone attending the recent Innovation Forum Ethical Sourcing Conference in London may recall our presentation from La Isla Project and Diageo into research into how in-the-field interventions can make a huge difference to the health of agricultural workers in the tropics. Florida farm worker groups are unsurprisingly very concerned at the legislation's potential impact. However, there is some better news. An initiative titled the Fair Food Programme, which is a partnership involving retailers, farmers and farm workers, has developed strong and reportedly legally binding heat protocols for Florida's farms, bypassing the Republican-controlled state Senate altogether. The programme originated in Florida's tomato sector and expects to operate in 25 US states, protecting farm workers this year. It is supported by the US Department of Agriculture. Its heat protocol mandates shade on fields, water and a rest break every 2 hours in Florida's fields from April to November, the state's hottest months. I was delighted to speak recently with Joseph De Cruz, CEO of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, and Olivier Tichet, Chief Sustainability Officer from Muslim Mass, to catch up on the latest developments in the implementation of the EU's deforestation regulation. We're going to talk a little bit about the European Union deforestation regulation. Olivier, perhaps we can start by taking stock of where we are in the implementation phase of the EUDR. Where are we in that process?
Well, Ian, we're at the same time very close and very far, if I may. I think for palm, we're about 6 months away from the first shipments that will have to be EUDR compliant. And there's still plenty to do on the EU side, if I may. There was a trial of the IT platform That seems to be advancing. There might be even an interface with other systems, and that's maybe the good news. There's also the promise of commodity-specific information, guidelines on legality, what will be meant as legality, also on the risk assessment that we are supposed to carry out and what is negligible risk, the clarification of what is agricultural use, the role of third-party verifications, like the RSPO, let's say. And so that might give you a sense of, I think that's a bit late. I mean, all this has been promised for the end of May. We are running a bit out of time. And there's been some confusing recent declarations that the risk benchmarking for the countries will be postponed. And that's unnecessary confusion. So a bit of progress. I think a lot of the actors have been progressing, we've all been preparing, but the EU is not helping us at the moment. I wish I had some more positive news to report on that.
But everything is still going forward on the basis of full implementation in December 2024.
Yes.
From Moussa Massi's perspectives then, what are your principal concerns?
We had tools that we had to adjust to comply with the EUDR requirements. Our main concern is the same as from the beginning. We must remain super conservative. EUDR is a no-tolerance regulation with pretty hefty fines or consequences. That has been confirmed by the EU, which means that we have to be more exclusive than we can be inclusive. Even though there's Article 11, I mean, for those who like to quote the articles or to look into the articles, Article 11 on remediation, we still have to use it in a very, very conservative manner. So to speak plainly, what that means, a highly selective supply base, that means very few smallholders, and that means logistical issues or logistical ways of dealing with the regulation that will be a bit unwieldy and most likely not cheap at all.
What does zero tolerance regulation mean?
It means, strictly speaking, no deforestation whatsoever. I mean, what they look at, no deforestation is half a hectare, and the forest is defined as for the FAO. And that means it's an extremely restrictive way of looking at deforestation. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to exclude deforestation from the supply chains. It's just that there's basically no tolerance, and there is, most important, no way of saying we found out after the fact, or we found out during the processing that there was an issue, we're trying to deal with it, the shipment will still go ahead. But the point is, because of the regulation, we would have found, a bit like in the RSP, if you want, you might find issues, or with our own due diligence tools, we might find issues. It doesn't mean that we need to exclude or to take away some product out of the market. It means we found it, we had the intention to carry out due diligence, we have carried out due diligence, we have monitoring systems in place, we found issues. How do we address them? Can we address them? Are the suppliers willing to change some practices or to address some issues they might have found? Which means we can keep them in a supply chain, which is supporting change, which is supporting better practices. That the EUDR is not giving us an opportunity to do that. And that, of course, for our customers is a major concern. How are they going to remain compliant? How can we basically help them remain compliant, knowing that we do not want to pass on an extra risk to them? How are they going to transition, let's say, from the current situation where they have stocks of non-EUDR material to EUDR material? How are they going to be able to pass on the information or to carry or to verify the information that we passed on to them? Let's say the due diligence statements, for example. There's still a lot of things a bit up in the air.
You talked about Article 11 on remediation. What does this Article 11 contain? What are the measures within it?
Well, basically, it's telling us that we should be able to remediate to issues that are found during the due diligence. It says that we could require additional information, data or documents, carrying out independent surveys or audits, or taking other measures pertaining to information requirements of the famous Article 9, which has all sorts of information. The problem is, at the end of the day, we still have a regulation, and that's been confirmed, that has no tolerance. So how can we remediate at the end, if we found any issues? We cannot. And most important, it's not in one at one step. Let's say if we, Musimas, were the only ones liable, we could say we take not a risk, but we take a chance because we are confident that our supply chain is good. But we have to pass on that due diligence statement, or we have to pass on that information and that risk further down the supply chain. And everybody remains liable as per the regulation. The mitigation becomes a bit meaningless.
How will the regulation then impact delivery of palm oil to your customers day to day?
Well, I've got good news for our customers, as I'm sure most of my competitors have. We've obviously tried to limit that to the minimum. This being said, there will be some extra administration. There's a lot more documentation to pass around. There will be more checks, likely. We have some customers, especially at the beginning, who will ask for some extra information. And shipping, obviously, is going to be the main issue because we cannot mix EUDR compliant products with products which are not confirmed as being EUDR compliant. They might be perfectly compliant, but if we've not carried out due diligence on them, we cannot mix them. So that will be manageable, but that comes at a cost. It will reduce, basically for EU customers, what it does, that it reduces their potential supply chain, reduces their choices. That's a bit of a problem, obviously. Also, we know the regulation is bound to change, is bound to evolve over time. It's unclear as to when and how. If you look at the recent declarations, it's end of May. It was before, it was supposed to be at other times. Now it's end of May. The IT system is working the way it is. There's been some more delays in some of the important parts of the regulation or the benchmarking, sorry, at least one. It's a bit of a confusion. That's what I'm worried about. It's the confusion it creates as to how perennial with their supply of palm products in our case or other products will be.
You mentioned that the regulation reduces supply chain choices. You're referring there to the removal of smallholder farmers from supply chains?
Yes, that one in particular, that's one of the unintended consequences of the EUDR. And that means that as we have a no threshold, so everybody must be compliant or nobody is compliant, if you have a supply base with 10,000 smallholders, let's say, or 5,000 smallholders for a mill, possibly, if one of them you cannot reasonably demonstrate that they are compliant, you have at the moment to take them out. Again, the EU tells us they will give us more clarity, but it's a bit late. I mean, we cannot wait until much later in the year, until we determine what are the sources which will be EUDR compliant. Now we start stocking, we start segregating, we start processing, we will be shipping in about 6 months' time. It's too late. So we might be able to change a little bit our approach, but this is like a very big ship. It will take a while to move. It has to be set in the right direction at the right speed. Otherwise, you cannot change course easily.
What are the other then long-term implications, do you think, of the regulation?
Well, the main concern is that there might be some, I'm going to use an ugly word or an ugly expression, demand destruction in the EU for some, typically some products. And that might come because some small or medium, large size industrial actors might decide that it's not in their best interest to use this or that or to do it in the EU. It will have possibly also some origins might be considered at too high a risk, and they will be then excluded. There are obviously worries about that. And that might not be recuperated, even though the EUDR or whatever happens in the near future is changed and made a bit more sensible, or we've developed better tools to comply. But most importantly, I believe it undoes the fabric of multi-stakeholder initiatives, a bit like in the RSPO. And the RSPO is a standard, so it goes a bit further. It undoes the fabric of initiatives like that, which are about developing, improving tools for achieving not only no deforestation, but achieving also social progress. No exploitation in a collaborative manner, in a multi-stakeholder manner, in a progressive manner. The RSPO was not made in one day. It developed a lot of tools over time, which can be used by other industries. And the only reason it did so is that it was not a zero-tolerance game. It was always, we must comply with certain standards. There are ways of dealing with non-conformances or non-compliance, but always in the spirit of, right, how do we do better next time? How do we do better next time? How do we keep doing better? How do we make it so that everybody can be in the room and everybody can be included in the market?
And have the EU made any progress on these concerns of yours, do you think?
I think the EU is maybe finally realizing what a monster they've created. I mean, the ambition is extraordinary. That's nice. I don't mind the fact that there's high ambition. At the end of the day, it's a bit, sorry, JD, I'm not trying to be nice to you, but it's a bit like the RSPO or these multi-stakeholder standards. You have to set very high ambitions. Why? Because there are things that have to be done, that have to be invented. So that's great. But I think the EU, in the way that it developed the EUDR, made so much of a restrictive approach or so much of an exclusive approach, saying, well, enough is enough, but we don't want to discuss anymore, and you will be fully liable, and we are going to set requirements that are extremely strict. But they maybe did so without enough consultation. They didn't take enough time to set a system that would have been a bit more inclusive, and that would, most important, that would have fostered progress instead of saying we want a perfect supply chain and that's the end of the game. That, I think, is the main issue. If you look at other countries, they're looking more at legality, which might be a lower ambition. But at least it will be likely to be a bit more inclusive over time, because you can increase the access, in particular of smallholders, to being fully legal. But the EUDR, unfortunately, has a very high ambition, but is a bit too much in a hurry. I think that, in a nutshell, is where I would put it.
JD, for you then at RSPO, what has been the response to the EUDR?
Thanks, Olivier, for saying a lot of things here, which I'm now going to agree with wholeheartedly. In terms of the RSPO's response, let me answer that in two forms. First of all, what do we think about the EUDR, both in terms of its structure and its ambition? And secondly, what are we doing as a standard system and a platform to support our members in responding to it? So, what do we think about the EUDR? Much as Olivia said, in principle, efforts by organizations like the EU to reduce deforestation are things that we welcome, provided these are going to result in clear pressure to reduce deforestation. And in that regard, I would have two concerns about the way the EUDR is formed. First of all, given, as Olivia has quite eloquently described, the structure of the regulation, the first risk is that the regulation simply shifts deforestation-tainted products or questionable products to other markets and simply excludes them from the EU market. So in reality, the risk is that you're not going to change the pattern of deforestation risk on the ground. You're simply going to shift the deck chair, so to speak, and segment the market so that volumes go to Europe from the places that are already the cleanest and the most robust, which is in many cases are producers that are RSPO certified according to our segregated and energy protected supply chains. And the second point is the point that Olivia made around zero tolerance. As Olivia rightly said, experience has shown that if you want to provoke positive change in the market, what you need to focus on is creating a system that incentivizes producers to improve performance. Whereas a zero tolerance benchmark has been put in place here, reduces the incentive for producers, buyers, smallholders to engage in those places where further progress is needed. Precisely because you then have to engage in those messy gray areas where you now run the risk of being hit with quite punitive fines. The net result of the EUDR structure is, in some respects, I believe it reduces the EU's ability to provoke positive change on deforestation and other standards in the areas where it's needed the most, and simply shifts those areas outside the ambit of ever being able to engage with the EU as a market. And that's very unfortunate. Now, what are we doing about this as the RSPO? Our focus has been to work with our members to, first of all, be able to demonstrate compliance with the regulation, both in terms of the systems and standards the RSPO has for sourcing and proving deforestation-free products, but also a tremendous investment in digital systems and infrastructure that allow our members to be able to transmit that deforestation-free information along the supply chain to first importers in Europe so that they're able to actually deal with the challenge of traceability, which is in some respects one of the biggest challenges of the EUDR for supply chains like palm. The issue is less in whether the supplies at source are deforestation-free, but given the complexity of the supply chain, it is often a challenge for marginal producers and smallholders in particular to be able to convey their product and the associated information to buyers in Europe using a verifiable supply chain. And that's something that we're working on as well.
To what extent do you think that the concerns that Olivier has raised are shared by the palm sector as a whole? Are there other views from your members, or is Olivier voicing the sector's concerns?
I think Olivier's captured the sector's concerns very well. There are, of course, variations in terms of our producers, some who are highly vertically integrated and therefore have a much greater ability to provide product to the EU market in a way that is certified to be deforestation free, and others, particularly smallholder groups or producers in more marginal landscapes which don't have robust supply chains, that are effectively going to be almost entirely excluded from the European market in the future. I think Olivia and Musima sit somewhere in the middle there because of their long history of engaging with large groups of smallholders, where they deeply recognize the impact this is going to have on those smallholder groups, while still being a large and robust enough company to continue to be able to supply Europe and their customers there as needed.
Implementation is due at the end of the year. How do you think that the process of implementation will play out?
With a great deal of uncertainty, there are a number of unanswered questions that limit our ability as a system and as a sector to be able to demonstrate compliance, even though at source, at the farm gate, we know that there is more than enough deforestation-free production available to be able to meet not just Europe's demand, but far beyond that. How we prove it, how we transmit that information in a way that meets the EU's requirements is uncertain at this point because the details of those requirements have not yet been made fully clear. And even once they're made fully clear, it will take a while for producers to build the systems needed to transmit that information, and also to be able to get products sourced and shipped to Europe that meet those regulatory requirements. So unfortunately, a lot of details are unclear and time is not on our side at this point.
Okay, let's think about one of the implications that we talked about earlier. How concerned are you that we're going to simply see a fragmentation into better palm oil destined for EU markets and worse palm oil for elsewhere? How significant are your concerns around that?
I think at least in the short term, that is one of the most obvious consequences of this regulation. What it does is, rather than using the market power of the European market to continue to push producers and countries to become better at dealing with deforestation, it simply segments the market into a walled garden on the one side and a bit of a free-for-all on the other. And so in that sense, it could actually reduce the impetus and the momentum for producers to continue to push for deforestation-free production.
Cooperation is clearly going to be necessary for palm oil and other commodities to deal with these issues, to deal with the implementation of the EUDR. What cooperation are you seeing across commodities to meet the challenges?
From the RSPO side, we communicate with, coordinate with, and cooperate with many of the other sustainability standards for agricultural commodities that are impacted by the EUDR, both on a bilateral basis as well as through global platforms like the ICEED Alliance, which is the International Alliance of Voluntary Standards for Sustainability. We've seen in those conversations that many of the other commodities within the scope of the EUDR are likely to be impacted at least as badly as palm, and in many cases, probably worse. Simply because, and I say this with a certain level of pride in the work of my forebears, the palm sector over the last 20 years has invested a tremendous amount of effort in setting up rigorous, transparent, credible systems to be able to demonstrate sustainability, not just in terms of deforestation free, but in terms of contributions on a range of people, planet, and prosperity indicators. This is not necessarily the case in other commodities. And so I'm not only hearing concern from my peers about how they're going to comply, but there's a lot of interest in learning from the palm sector in terms of the systems and structures we've put in place.
Olivier, what are the next steps you want to see through 2024?
Oh, something very simple, because it's too late now maybe to change the implementation or the initial phases of the implementation. So what I would love to see happening is the EU maybe open up a little bit, build on what it's done so far with the joint task force with Indonesia and Malaysia, and create a genuinely open consultative group for EUDR phase two or EUDR two or whatever we want to call it. But something that would allow the industry, the governments, some NGOs and schemes like the RSPO, but also the terminal markets like the ICE and others, to review how we're going to indeed make sure that producers who might be compliant with the EUDR are at the moment excluded just because of what JD said. How do you pass on the information? How do you demonstrate the information is correct? So bring a new approach to the EUDR without reducing its ambition, but turn it into a way of actually realizing that ambition in a much more inclusive manner. It's about focusing on the quality of the system, on the verification of the due diligence systems. I think so far there's been indications from the EU or for some of the national competent authorities that they will be focusing on the systems, which I think is really positive, and then putting really a lot of emphasis also on how we can use better that Article 11 on remediation so that we can actually keep including producers instead of having to exclude them.
JD, anything to add?
Beyond looking at the lessons on how we can make EUDR better, more positive and more impactful, I think it's also important for us to learn the lessons from this experience and apply them to the raft of other sustainability regulations and initiatives that are being considered, discussed and put in place in the EU and in other markets. There are lots of lessons we can learn from the weaknesses as well as the positives of EUDR that we can then apply to how regulators are approaching other much more complex issues like labor and forced labor risks within supply chains, like the risk of human rights abuses. Those are in many ways vastly more complex issues to tackle than deforestation. And if we approach them without a certain level of care and without listening to and learning from the very vast experience industries like ours have in dealing with them, there is a risk that you will cause much greater disruptions to global commodity and other supply chains, which is something I think the world can ill afford today.
Olivia, I mean, just to echo that point, do you think that to a large extent the EU missed a trick here in not coming to the palm oil sector and working with the huge amount of experience that palm oil's had in dealing with these issues over the past 20 years? I mean, things were not good 20 years ago. It's been a huge change. Do you think the EU should perhaps have learned more from palm oil's experience?
Simply said, yes. I think JD has expressed it better than I could, but I do believe, yes, indeed. There's been more than enough progress, definitely in the palm sector. We've invented enough tools. We maybe are not the only ones who have invented tools, but the palm sector was very early and really did its best to invent or to support the invention of tools that were applicable as broadly as possible. But I fully agree with JD as well on the fact that if we do not pay attention to what is happening with this regulation, which is focusing on deforestation, we're going to have even worse experiences with upcoming regulations on labor and human rights. So indeed, the EU could come to us in more, and also to the rubber sector, to the cocoa sector, to the coffee sector. Coffee has been working on labor issues for quite a while already, with some success as well. So I believe there is a wealth of experience, and we are not closed to discussion, rather the opposite. I think our sector has learned that. It has learned that multi-stakeholder initiatives, that communication is not our enemy, openness is not our enemy, rather the opposite.
So JD, what for you will success look like, and how likely is that success, do you think?
In the context of the EUDR specifically, I think success will be measured by the degree to which we can ensure that the most marginalized and vulnerable producers still continue to be supported and encouraged to become more sustainable in their production, even if in the short term, they might find themselves excluded from the European market. If that does come to pass, at least in the short term, I think we as consumers, as regulators, as industries, as buyers, need to continue to find ways to demonstrate we are supporting those marginal producers in their journey towards sustainability. And the RSPO has many tools, many programs, independent credits, for instance, which allow people to continue to provide that support for positive change, separate from the impact of EUDR itself. In the longer term, I think that shift in approach that Olivia described so eloquently is critical, that we need to start to see that dealing with sustainability challenges on the ground in agricultural landscapes is not an adversarial problem. It's not a problem of one sector or one actor attempting to impose solutions on others. It is a place where progress can only be made if all of us who are like-minded actors are able to come together, share experience, share resources, and align our capacities to be able to make positive change on the ground. That's the essence of what the RSPO was created for. That's the mandate and the mantle that my team and I have inherited, and we're very, very keen to ensure that we build on that in the years to come with regulators like the EU, with other markets, and with consumers and buyers as well.
And I guess it's the implementing incremental change is what will make the ultimate improvements more likely.
Absolutely. It's positive change. It is assessing whether producers, others involved in the supply chain are making the right efforts, putting the right systems in place to ensure progress on these indicators. Taking a zero tolerance approach, as Olivia described just now, doesn't help because in some respects, it simply makes the step up to sustainable production so steep that many people will feel they have no choice but to give up on that and revert back to unsustainable short-termism. And that's exactly the outcome that all of us don't want to see.
Olivier, back to you. For you, what will success look like and how likely is it, do you think, to pass?
Well, I'm quite encouraged because JD mentioned the credits for independent smallholders. We support 6 at the moment groups of smallholders who are RSPO certified. So every year we help them sell their credits because it's the best way to get them a direct reward for their certification and ensure their entire crop is sold as certified, or at least they can benefit from their entire production. We have managed to close a deal just last week with a very large multinational, which has big operations in Europe, and they have not retracted or they have not stopped supporting independent smallholders who are RSPO certified, despite the fact that they are highly exposed to the EUDR. So I'm quite encouraged to see that there are values out there. There are people out there who are still very willing to not look only at the risk that they have in terms of legal compliance, but keep supporting change in our commodity. We will continue having success to go beyond the EU regulations and be able to still have change and support change in our commodity, in our branch. We have to keep being inclusive to get to change. Our main job for us in our supply chain is to tell our suppliers that having better practices, being very transparent with their performance and practices is actually good for business. So that's what I would like to see. I would like to see an inclusive, demanding is fine. As long as we have the tools to be demanding, we impose a threshold or a step if you want to achieve compliance, which is too high, you cannot expect most actors to be interested in being compliant. They will just continue with their standard practices and you will have missed the opportunities. I would love to see the EU do whatever, something that allows us to be more inclusive and to maintain that momentum, which has been developed very well in the palm sector.
Let's see how it plays out over the coming months. Thank you for your heroic levels of agreement, Joseph de Cruz from the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil and Olivier Tichet from Muslim Mass. Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
The Innovation Forum website is as ever the place to go for all the latest analysis and interviews and all the details about our upcoming conference series and how to join us. And there is plenty more content about EUDR, its implementation and consequences. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.